Buenas.
Welcome back to Film Posers for Boricuas ranting, raving, and reviewing cinema. Today, we are going to be doing what can be considered our first directorial breakdown. We have done film breakdowns with the likes of Eraserhead and Blade Runner 2049. We've done actor breakdowns with the likes of Keanu Reeves. And now we're doing director breakdowns. And our first ever analysis of a director's filmography will be that of the modern day auteur that is Wes Anderson. And this episode will be moderated by me, Josie Melendez.
AKA the fell of Wes Anderson stan.
Just going into it, a little bit of info about Wes Anderson in terms of critical reception, his style, etc. His films are welcomed by what seems to be their target audience, named as art house viewers, which often seems to be composed of younger viewers due to the quirky and colorful nature of the films, but not too young where the mature themes are missed. Oftentimes, the films do very well with great ratings, with the exception of The Life Aquatic of Steve Zissou and The Darjeeling Limited, which are regarded as his least popular films, though Steve Zissou has details within the film that have become trademark visuals of Anderson amongst fans. Example, The Red Beanies. Now, when it comes to industry reception, Wes Anderson is regarded as a genre within himself. He is recognized for his own style, and some have even declared it to be changing the way films are being made when it comes to certain subjects or simply the visual aspects of a film on its own. Many have declared that Wes Anderson has cleverly been able to be successful within Hollywood without having to sacrifice his vision for the sake of fitting the mold that Hollywood so often requires. He has found a loophole that so many desire to grasp and own for themselves and their craft. Accordingly, he is a writer-director that is either highly valued, admired, and respected for his distinctive taste, or he is disregarded, cast aside, and considered overrated, which can be seen throughout parodies made by shows such as SNL and Family Guy. Now, when it comes to awards, he has been nominated for many awards and has won his fair share. The Grand Budapest Hotel was actually the first film to bring him a win at the Academy Awards. It was nominated for 9 categories, including his first director and best picture nominations, but it only brought home 4, those being best original score, best production design, best makeup and hairstyling, and best costume design. When it comes to writing, Anderson often collaborates on screenplays with Owen Wilson, Noah Baumbach, Roman Coppola, and Jason Schwartzman. And when it comes to actors, those often found in an Anderson film are Luke Wilson, Owen Wilson, Andrew Wilson, so the 3 Wilson brothers, Kumar Palana, Jason Schwartzman, Bill Murray, Seymour Cassel, Angelica Houston, Larry Pine, Willem Dafoe, Jeff Goldblum, Morris Adwalia, Adrian Brody, Edward Norton, Tilda Swinton, and Bob Balaban. So, considering that this was the first time watching Wes Anderson films for the majority, first reactions to his work before we get into the specific films we were supposed to watch, starting with Juan.
Before this episode, I saw The Grand Budapest Hotel, and I loved it, and I saw Moonrise Kingdom. Those are the only 2 Wes Anderson films I had previously seen. After watching these films, I enjoyed it for the most part. I think it was nice to see some of his filmography that I just never got to. I do like his directorial style for the most part. I think when it works, it really works. And I saw the films in the order that they were chronologically released, and seeing his style evolution was great. But after a certain point, seeing them back to back to back, because I binged them literally one right after the other, I will say I do not recommend that method because it got repetitive for me. So either you really have to love those movies to watch them back to back to back. Yeah. Or if you're new to it, you're going to get tired really quick. And that's not fair because his films do get better, in my opinion, as you watch them. So I personally, for the most part, enjoyed my experience. I would watch another Wes Anderson film, preferably The French Dispatch, but we'll get to that.
Yeah. Yeah, we were talking about this earlier that it does become repetitive, mostly because Wes Anderson is regarded as an auteur because of his consistent style and yeah. themes, etc. But at least he plays around with it. It's like we compared it to Nicholas Sparks. You know how the stories are often the same, but they change the characters and the setting. That's how it feels. But at least like Wes Anderson makes it a little bit more dynamic. But one thing that I really like about him is that he improves with each film. So it gets me excited for the next one.
I agree. And he expands his color palette because before in the early ones, I noticed that he liked yellow a lot.
Yes.
And I got annoyed. But then with Grand Budapest, he liked, you know, shades of mauve and pink and purple and blue. And I'm here like, good, let's keep this. I don't want to go back to yellow because after a while I got sick of looking at the yellow color palette. But again, I binged them, so that's on me. But I will say, I agree. He does get better with each film, which
yeah,
is great.
I'm genuinely excited for The French Dispatch.
Same. If the film posters would like to be sent a screener or manifesting that, we would love to see it in our inbox.
We're just going to crash the Cannes Film Festival.
Yep.
We're just going to parachute in onto the Emily in Paris set and walk.
This is our submission for our unofficial accreditation.
Better late than never.
We would be great critics.
Oui, je parle français. S'il vous plaît.
Oui, oui, baguette.
Oui, oui, baguette. Bisous.
Creole lady marmalade.
Posers in Paris.
I have my beret ready.
Oh my god.
I'm going to Forever 21.
Going back, Anna, you're next. What was your first reaction to his filmography?
Before this binge watch, I already seen The Grand Budapest, Moonrise Kingdom, and Fantastic Mr. Fox. I have never seen the first films he has ever done. So I appreciated how in each film you could see that little by little he's adding more style to it. And I agree with you guys. He certainly gets better with storytelling. Because honestly, like the first films, they didn't captivate me as much as his newer ones.
Yeah, it feels like he gets more comfortable with each turn.
Yeah, he does, certainly. Because honestly, like I tried to like some of his old films, but I just couldn't get past by it.
Yeah.
I was not a bit bored, but I would have loved to see more with the story because it definitely gets repetitive.
What about you, Gabriela?
So, I'm here, like, ready to go on an apology tour because before this, I had never seen a Wes Anderson film. You know, I thought I had seen Grand Budapest, but then I realized I confused it with The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel.
Yep. Which is a good film, by the way.
Yeah. So I had never seen a Wes Anderson film, which, yeah, I have no explanation for it. So I went into it, and the first film I saw was Fantastic Mr. Fox. And I went out of order. I didn't watch them in order like the rest of the posers did. I just kept watching them in order of the ones that were on streaming services. And I struggled. It was so hard for me to complete this watch because I was not having a good time. I was very bored throughout the entirety of the watch. There was only one film that I liked out of the six that I watched. Only one. So it was rough. I discovered that Wes Anderson is not for me. I couldn't connect with his stories. I was just mostly bored the entire time. And it was not because of the style of the directing or the production value of the films, because that part I love. It's mostly because of the scripts that I couldn't connect with the characters. I just found the characters really annoying most of the time. And so I know I have to go into hiding, because as soon as I gave Fantastic Mr. Fox 2 stars, I knew Josie was going to come after me and murder me.
Wow.
And this is Gabriela's official I'm not going to Cannes speech.
I'm not saying I don't want to go to Cannes, because I want to go to Cannes. Hint, hint. But I'm just saying that I did not have a good time in this rewatch, and I'm just being honest. Because I tried.
We appreciate your honesty.
It was rough.
Okay, so let's get into the films then. So the audience may know, what made Gabriela feel this way? So before I mention them, just some common themes that you can notice in the films that we watched is that you will often see people falling apart, and oftentimes people that hold themselves highly, or they have a high other people hold them with a high regard. And then also adults are kids and kids are adults. So you will see that often as well. Wes Anderson takes a lot of inspiration from the French New Wave, so that includes like Jean-Luc Godard and François Truffaut, as well as Orson Welles and Citizen Kane specifically. And then when it comes to the visual language, you'll see a lot of symmetrical central frame shots. You'll see the usage of white lenses and straight lines that often create the illusion of depth and atmosphere and perspective. So that's often what you'll notice when it comes to him and what has set him apart from many other directors. But let's get into it with his feature debut. Now, Bottle Rocket, released in 1996, it is his lowest grossing film, labeled as a crime comedy. It was written by both Wes Anderson and Owen Wilson, based on the short film of the same name. First reactions. One.
So yes, Bottle Rocket was the first Wes Anderson film I saw for this marathon. And I can be completely honest. I thought it was simple. I thought at times it was fun. Yeah. It had some fun moments. But I felt it's mainly empty, because this is one of the few Wes Anderson films where I felt there isn't much of a plot that's developed.
Yeah.
And while I could see his directorial charm in the terms of the screenplay and how he directs, it's his weakest and most underdeveloped film, which it's his first film. Sometimes that can be expected. And I thought the characters were somewhat likable, but they weren't completely developed. I really can't tell you what happens in this movie, because you said it was a crime comedy. And I'm here like, where was it? Because...
Yeah. It definitely feels like the blueprint for Grand Budapest when you think about it, in terms of that burglary and all that. It just reminded me a lot of what Grand Budapest became and is. But the problem with Bottle Rocket also is that a lot of things are set up, but none of them follow through.
Exactly.
Or at least not all of them.
Yes, it set up a lot of things, and it could have been great. But I also feel like you said it was his first film, so maybe there wasn't enough of a budget to produce everything maybe he wanted to. Yeah. Because I know he can get chaotic. So
yeah, because this one feels so much more rooted in reality as opposed to all his other works, because a lot of the other ones are actual sets. Like, they feel like literal dollhouses, and there's a lot of theatricality to his style and everything that happens later. But Bottle Rocket is a lot more rooted in reality. It has a lot of in-location shots and scenes. And also, it just doesn't feel like him. It feels more like someone mimicking his style than him actually making a film. So you can tell that this is literally him at his youngest and earliest in his career.
Yeah. So overall, for me, it's not a bad directorial debut film, but it's not memorable at all.
No, it's just missing a lot of the heart that comes from him.
Yeah, very much.
Anna.
So, I'll be honest, this is... I'm gonna forget this movie. It's not memorable.
No.
The story... It tries to develop some plot. It tries to develop a plot. But where is it? Where is it? And at the same time, like, there's like a couple stories within the movie, but it doesn't get well developed, and
yeah, it could have been tighter. That's the thing. If the script had been like short and sweet,
it's missing that flow, that like kinetic energy flow.
Exactly. It needed it, like, that's it, like, better connecting points between one thing and the other. And it doesn't have to be like, and then this happens, and then this happens, and then this happens. But add a little bit, like, more dynamic, because there is a lot of empty space in between. So it's mostly that.
Completely agree.
This movie feels like Wes Anderson is testing the waters with filmmaking. Yeah.
Because it felt very trepidatious and nervous.
Yeah, because, like, you can see a little bit of style, but at the same time, he's kind of afraid to go full-blown.
Yeah.
Something that you see now in his latest films, but this one is like, there's something there that he hasn't quite figured out.
Hints. And
throughout the, like, his filmography, like, little by little, él se va soltando.
Okay, so I saw this film this week and I don't remember it anymore. Like, I just remember that Luke and Owen Wilson are in it.
Also, Owen Wilson doesn't say wow.
Right? No, he doesn't say wow.
He doesn't go wow. I didn't hear that. So automatically I took off a star.
No. Bye. Royal Tenenbaums, 2001.
Oh, right. I also watched this one. God.
So this one was co-written between Anderson and Owen Wilson again. Here we see a larger cast compared to Bottle Rocket. Thoughts? This time we're going in a different order. Gabriela, you start us off.
So I like the cast and I like the directing. So I don't know. I think it's the story started off really well. I like the character introductions at the beginning. But then at one point I thought, oh, it's ending. And it had 40 more minutes left. And I was irritated by that.
Yeah, that's a common theme when it comes to these films.
I was very irritated that I had 40 more minutes left. And I don't know. I feel like it could have easily been an hour long. We didn't need the extra 40 minutes.
Okay, Anna.
Okay, so I actually kind of like this film. Like, it's not...
I mean, perfect. It was better than Bottle Rocket.
Exacto. It's not perfect, but I like the cast. I like the family dynamic going on. I like how the father was trying. I like the conversations that went, like, around him and his children. I like that dynamic. And especially, like, I don't know why. I don't know about you guys, but I kind of, like, wanted, like, I almost choked up with Ben Stiller with that scene where he's talking to his dad and he said, "I had a rough year, Dad." That scene almost made me cry. Not gonna lie.
My reaction was, "Who didn't have a rough year, man?"
Oh my god!
I know that's right. Yeah.
The thing with Wes Anderson is that I've noticed that even if I might not be enjoying a film, he really gets you with, like, one specific scene that makes you reevaluate everything. That happened to me with Life Aquatic, which we will get into. So he's really good at doing that.
Same. Like, there are some scenes that, you know what, they're kind of forgetful, but there are others that they just hit you.
Yeah.
With the dialogue and the characters, like, interacting with each other.
Yeah, sometimes it feels like he really understands people.
Yeah.
Because he reduces, most often what you'll notice with Wes Anderson filmography is that he reduces people to, like, the simplest form that they can be. And again, with the whole, it's especially visible in this film, that the whole kids are adults and adults are kids. Often what you will see is that adults say things like it is, and they're very straightforward, kind of like children. They're very honest and direct, as opposed to, like, often how you see adults making things more complicated than they should. But they also oftentimes act like, again, children in the worst sense, where they should be the adults and be mature, and they lack that, especially with the male figures who often come off as the man child. And then when it comes to the children, they are actually very intelligent, very self-sufficient, very independent. Their vocabulary is a lot more sophisticated than you would expect for their age. So Wes Anderson gives them a sort of agency and allows them to be seen as more capable than often children are.
Yeah, and that's something that we especially see in Moonrise Kingdom.
Yes.
Okay, so I had a better time with Royal Tenenbaums than I did with Bottle Rocket.
I think we all did.
Yeah, we all did.
Yeah.
I liked certain parts of this film. For example, one of my favorite things was when they were introducing Gwyneth Paltrow's character. I feel like she had a similar effect to Alexis in Schitt's Creek when she talks about her adventures. Mm-hmm. In the sense of, like, I could see a separate film just of these adventures, because this sounds entertaining to me. Also, it was nice to see the film that inspired the SNL skit, The Midnight Coterie of Sinister Intruders, which Wes Anderson, I want that slasher film. Anna, let's push that agenda.
You know that he's considered, there have been rumors that he's considered a horror film, and there are rumors that he's considered of making a musical. So, I'm waiting.
I'm here for the horror.
But yes, Royal Tenenbaums.
Yeah. Overall, I thought it was entertaining and quirky for the most part. I thought the cinematography was great. When the jokes were made here, they really did land. I thought the cast was great. The soundtrack was a vibe. The pacing and the tone felt very uneven throughout the film. Because at one time, I'm having a great time, and then it gets too serious to the point where it's like, oh, you killed my vibe a bit. Like, not sure if I'm loving this. Because again, like Anna said, the beginning was great, but then it kind of got lost. And that's where I felt it dragged, especially in the third act. I got a bit bored. Even though the wedding chase scene, that was hilarious. That was hilarious, which is in the third act, and when the car crashes into the apartment. That was great.
Yeah, know, with this film, I had a lot of hope because Ben Stiller is in it. Yeah. And I hold him at a certain regard. And I really like that he was given substance with his character.
He got a really juicy role. He had a lot to play
with. He goes through so much, and he has what I call the character that is the epitome of Wes Anderson flicks. He has the most weight to carry, and he has the most to learn. And then that scene with his dad.
Yeah.
Just I'm happy he got that.
I agree. I will say though, there's a content / trigger warning. There is a suicide attempt where there's a cutting part, and it is a little graphic. You see part of it happening, but you see the aftermath. For me, it was very off-putting to see that.
Mm-hmm.
I did not enjoy seeing that at all. That took me out even. So if you are going to check out Royal Tenenbaums and you can't see those kind of scenes, there's the warning, because it is hard to sit through a bit. And it did for me like ruin a bit of the vibe I was having. So yeah, I could tell Anderson was still working on the pacing and the tone in that film.
Okay. Moving on to The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, 2004. Let's get into first reactions, and then I'll ask my question. Anna.
So, I had a little bit of trouble with finishing this movie because the pacing...
It's slow.
Yeah. The pacing didn't work for me. The story, I tried to be interested by it, but I wasn't that interested with the storyline. There were some scenes from the movie that I really liked. I'm gonna highlight some, like the where they go and try to like save their friend, the chasing on the hotel. I thought that was great.
Yes.
That was great. I thought that the scene where they saw the tiger shark for the first time, I thought it was great.
Yes.
And the last scene where they all go, you know, where Bill Murray, he just like doesn't care anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't even care to like see his award or anything. He just leaves.
I just left it in the stairs, and I was like, your award, sir.
But at the same time, that was some great character development, like, for him. But in like the middle of the movie, there's nothing more.
Yeah, with him specifically, when I was referring to the man-child trope that Wes Anderson often has, he is the perfect example, because he definitely acts like a child, especially in that scene where he's like talking to Owen Wilson's character Ned about how you expect certain things to be said about you, but they still hurt. The way he says it, it just sounds like when a child comes to you and they're like, they're bullying me at school, mom.
Yeah, and another example is how he constantly, like, he's kind of worried that his crewmates, they don't like him.
Yeah.
or that his like son doesn't like him, or his ex-wife doesn't talk to him.
Yeah, he's very emotionally stunted, and you can tell with the specific line that is pretty memorable, which, again, Wes Anderson, daddy issues the films. That's the filmography. Because it's this the line where he says, I'm probably butchering it, but when he says that I never liked fathers, so I never wanted to become one.
That hit me.
That hit me too.
So I think I'm the only film poser here who like really liked this film. I rated it the highest on Letterboxd with 4.5 out of 5. I actually loved my experience. I will say it is a little too long. Just a little bit, like 10 to 15 minutes.
It's the longest one because most of them tend to be like 1 hour and 30 minutes long, which I appreciate. And then Life Aquatic is 2 hours long.
And you feel the 2 hours.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah, the second longest I think was Royal Tenenbaums with like 1 hour and 50, and I felt that. But yeah, I really enjoyed The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou. I thought it was great. I also loved the chaotic moment of the pirate heist of the ship.
That was funny.
Fantastic for me. Because that came out of nowhere. That's where the chaos really started for me. And I'm here like, I see it. I love it. And plus.
Also, yeah.
I don't go on gay.
Can someone mention Willem Dafoe in shorts?
He was the best part. He stole the show.
He was like the blueprint for like, hot everyone summer.
Willem Dafoe is
fit. That fit. Like, he rocked it between the shorts and the beanie, honestly. He was ready for hot girl summer from the very beginning. He was ready.
Best dressed.
What year is this film from?
2004.
Okay. Yeah. He was ready for hot girl summer since 2004.
Willem Dafoe, he passed the fit check.
Yes, he does.
And I thought it was really funny. I thought I had a stellar cast. I thoroughly enjoyed it from beginning to end. I mean, come on. The movie started with Life on Mars by David Bowie. Of course I'm going to like it. That is like how you get me. And I could definitely see how this is Wes Anderson's most underappreciated film. But I'd also argue, while it may not be the most film poser, you know, approved theory, I actually think it's one of his best films.
Yeah. Which is surprising because, again, it is one of the least well-regarded films that he's made.
It bombed at the box office. It did not do well at that time. It's a film that could be considered ahead of its time.
But also I read that it has gained a bit of a cult classic since it was released, which tends to happen with films that don't do well in the box office and aren't that well-received, that, you know, they gain an audience later on in, like, their existence. So I mean, that's what happened with this one.
Collection.
It is?
In the Criterion collection. I'm adding that to my list of movies I have to buy for the collection.
And Bottle Rocket and The Royal Tenenbaums, it's also on the Criterion.
Wes Anderson is a list. Criterion darling.
So is Grand Budapest in the Criterion?
Yes, it is. I will talk about it when we talk about the movie. Oh,
thank God. I was going to riot if it wasn't.
Yeah,
he's very well regarded, mostly because of his style. But so this one is half and half, so I'm going to team up with Juan. I really enjoyed this film.
Yay!
At first, I wasn't that big of a fan because, again, pacing is just so slow and there are some filler scenes. But it's that ending. That ending got me. Mm-hmm. That ending got me, man. And I was like, you know what? You're not so bad after all.
Yeah,
definitely. I'm exposing myself. I was going to give this movie 2.5, but the ending convinced me, you know what? I'm going to pump it to 3-star.
Yeah.
It wrapped it up so nicely to the character. And it was, you know, it was great.
Also, it's just very adventurous. It's one of the most adventurous films I've seen of him. And Isle of Dogs exists. But again, when you think about the fact that this came out in 2004, you're like, huh.
I feel it was ahead of its time.
It was. Because it's very unique. I did not expect the use of animation and stop motion in this film.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very pleasantly surprised. So I like how it's very risky. It's also very large scale, which Grand Budapest, some people call it, it's his most large scale film and a little bit overwhelming at times. So I do enjoy how this one had a really good balance because it's still grounded in that reality, but we've already seen him develop into his true style, which is like the production design and the dollhouse like sets. Because most of the thing when it comes to Wes Anderson is that there is a theatricality to it. It really does feel like theater.
And like, I'm going to say that, you know, I liked, you know, out of the ones that I watched, I think I would rank Life Aquatic second place. Because I really did not expect where the story was going. I actually ended up having a lot of fun with this film by the end. Even though, to me, it dragged a bit at the beginning. And I thought it was also too long. But then the end does make up for it. So, and I also, I think the character dynamics in this film were some of the best.
Yeah. They really bounced off each other really well.
I really like that in this film. Yeah. I like this one I liked, and I actually watched this one today, so it's really fresh in my mind, and I did really like, you know, especially the ending. It really stood out to me.
Yeah, because my thing with Wes Anderson is that I don't adore him as a creator. My thing is that I respect him, because most of his films, there are very few that I can say that I actually do really enjoy. But when I see them, even if I'm not vibing with them, I will find something good to get out of them. Because he always has that one scene that hooks you in and you're like, okay, maybe you weren't so bad after all. But it's just, I see these films. And again, like, we could get into the fact that there is a significant lack of diversity. And most of these are very male-led. And usually the female characters feel mostly like women from the perspective of men instead of actual women. But when it comes to the production and everything, I respect what he's doing. And with this one, I was like, huh.
Yeah,
sir, you have vision.
The aesthetics of the film are what make it. Mm-hmm. Because in terms of script, I was just underwhelmed in terms of script. It kind of like, maybe it's just like a pet peeve of mine that I didn't like how the characters kind of feel like caricatures and they had to narrate every single thing that they were doing. I felt that there was a lot of telling.
Yeah, the problem with that is that is part of his style. Because he does do, like, these storybook kind of stories, not to be redundant, but because often you will see a book or a piece of literature included in the style. And then you have, like, the divisions kind of like chapters, because they're supposed to feel like acts or parts of a book or a play. And then most of the time, because you didn't see Moonrise Kingdom, that one really does it well.
Yep.
But especially like Correspondence and everything, he just has that specific style where it's mostly supposed to feel like someone is telling you a story.
This film, also Life Aquatic, what I liked is that it's doing the film within a film, that they're making a documentary and they are trying to, you know, learn from their mistakes, get their life lessons, get answers. And for me, that works narrative-wise when it comes to storytelling. And that's where I appreciated a bit more of the telling than showing.
Mm-hmm.
Although when they showed, for me, the showing was those fights in the hotel on the boat where they were being stolen, and in the other boat where they were stealing stuff, where it was Jeff Goldblum's character they were stealing from. I really like that, and
we love the Belafonte.
Jeff Goldblum in this film was so funny. Also,
he was.
I loved him.
And by the way, Josie, in the beginning when you saw the landscape, I was literally like, "This reminds me of Italy so much right now. I'm loving this."
And then it's Italy.
Exactly. I'm here like, the landscape is giving me Italy, and then you find out it's Italy, and I'm here like, this is for me. This was for me.
I was gonna say in Loke, I feel bad for Cody the dog, bro. The fact that they left it on the island. How dare they?
Well, hold on.
Surprisingly heartbreaking.
They returned him to his owner.
True.
Because Cody was originally with the pirates. So in a sense, you could say that he was returning him to the owners, even though Cody wanted to stay with Bill Murray more than the pirates, because I felt Bill Murray took better care of the dog, which also plays into the fatherhood aspect of man's best friend. You know, you can raise a dog, maybe you can raise a child, maybe you can care for a child, because he was really drawn to Cody and wanted to like take care of him. Mm-hmm. So when you bring up the quote of,
I never wanted to be one.
Exactly. That you're like, well, you can be a father to this dog, you can't be a father to your potential son. And he starts, that was when I felt the seed started to be planted to be like, okay, maybe I can change. Because I don't want the heartbreak that Cody felt to happen to the son.
But yeah, this film said bisexual rights because everyone's a little gay.
Yeah.
Facts.
And watching it on Pride Month.
Watching
it during Pride Month. That's...
Happy. In case we haven't said it, Happy Pride Month.
Happy Pride
Month. Yes, Happy Pride Month. We forgot to say it in the Studio Ghibli episode because, I mean, we recorded that before, like, the week before it aired. So, Happy Pride Month!
Happy Pride Month!
Yay! Woo! If you've made it this far, Happy Pride Month.
Yes. Let's thrive.
So, before we finish the segment with Life Aquatic, I just wanted to ask you guys, what do you think was the importance of the jaguar shark scene? Anna.
So, that was one of my favorite scenes of the film. And I thought it was a really beautiful scene with the character because you see him grow. Because, as Josie said, he had, like, a very childish behavior. But in here, you see, you know what? He moves on.
Yeah.
He finds purpose again in what he's going to do with his life. And you see him change in a way. You see him that he doesn't care about the worries that what people see at him. He just now does everything for himself. And you see that at the end where he just runs away from his award. So, yeah, that's him realizing, you know what? I'm going to do like everything for myself.
Yeah, what I really enjoyed about that scene is that we see him cry, because most of the film he's suppressing his emotions, and we see, like, we understand the anger, but usually that's the only emotion that men are allowed to have when it comes to toxic masculinity. So to see him actually feel his feelings and cry and be moved by something and letting go was very moving.
So for me, the jaguar shark throughout the movie and the ending was the grieving process as well as a form of catharsis and closure, because throughout the film, the documentary is about finding this jaguar shark and getting, like, avenging his friend who got killed by the shark. So Steve Zissou couldn't get past what happened, and he kept saying, I need to find the shark. And he was willing to sacrifice his reputation. He was willing to sacrifice what people thought of him. He didn't care about what certain people's morals were. He just wanted that closure. So for me, the jaguar shark was not only that, it's also the battle Steve Zissou himself was fighting. You know, at the same time, he was also battling bad press from his recent film. So he was trying to find financing and budget so he can make that film and try to do a comeback. So it was a lot of things that the shark, I feel, represented. But when he finds it at the end, he does feel not only a weight lifted off his shoulder, but he also realizes that he can move on, that it was not just finding the shark, it was saying goodbye to his friend, because he was robbed of that opportunity. He couldn't say goodbye to his friend, and it's that part of the grieving process that I felt he had the hardest time accepting. So he just started to project his emotions onto the crew.
Yeah, I'm pretty much on the same page. I think it was a moment of letting go for him. Because, you know, at the beginning of the film, everyone's like, the jaguar shark doesn't exist. And me, as a Animal Planet lover, I was like, there's no such thing as a jaguar shark. There are tiger sharks. There are bull sharks. There's no such thing as a jaguar shark. You are making it up, sir. But then it's like, oh, so there is a jaguar shark.
She was beautiful.
Yes, she was. But yeah, I do think it was just kind of like a symbolism of letting go. And it also felt, you know, how in in other films when the characters are chasing this one thing, and once they reach it, it's like when they realize that, oh, now I have to find another purpose in my life. They realize that, you know, they have other things that they have and that they should care about more than just this, you know, mission and this wanting to find this one thing. And I kind of thought that that was the case for him.
Yeah, that scene for me plays around a lot with the theme of insignificance, specifically with the line that he delivers that is, I wonder if it remembers me. Mm-hmm. That just hit deep, man. I sat there for a while. But yeah, it's a very moving scene, and I think it makes the film totally worth it. So I definitely recommend this film.
Otra escena que I really como que it hits hard también, mm-hmm, fue when they were doing the funeral for old Wilson.
Yeah, Ned.
Y todavía el coughing was like hundiéndose, pero veías a la ex esposa llorando, and it was because there was this scene where she said she didn't know if she wanted to be her mother or not. Como que she wasn't ready. But you see there, like, she was ready to be his mother.
Even though he said that Steve Zissou fired blanks.
See, it's most like that you could think that he was probably not the father. His son. Yeah. And now we'd like to take a moment to talk to you about our sponsor, Anchor, the easiest way to make a podcast. And we're back. Thank you for listening to our sponsor. Now, back to Wes Anderson. So the next film we're going to be discussing is Fantastic Mr. Fox from 2009. Now, we've already heard a bit of our first reactions, so let's get into some questions, and hopefully this will lead to a wonderful discussion. So these are questions that plague me whenever I watch this film, because nobody really has an answer. And no matter where you look, there are Reddit posts. Carsten Runquist made a video about it. Everyone tries to answer these questions, so let's see what's going on. The first question is, what do you think? Even these apples look fake, but at least they've got stars on them means, or what does it mean to you?
Okay, so I feel that line was representing how the Fox family, they didn't have much. They were living in the hole, and then they were upgrading to the tree, and they're trying to make their lives better. And when they started stealing, then he pointed to the apples, and it's like, sure, for you, it could just be an apple. But for me, this apple has the stars. So it was him valuing the importance of the little things that mattered for him, like food, shelter for his family, making sure they can have a better life. So his life meant something that they can say, oh, well, when he was around, he really provided for us. He really helped us move on up in the world and gave us a better life. So I felt the apple symbolism was meant to say that, yeah, for you, that could be nothing. But for me, that's like everything.
The apple was something that one of the guys that they robbed invented. And it was considered high class, or in a way, it's like, you know what? I don't know how to explain it because this is a hard question.
Yeah, which is ironic because most of like what leads up to that, Lo volvía a ver hoy. Uh-huh. And it's like, these goose crackers have synthetic goose in them, whatever. Uh-huh. Like, everything's fake. Yeah, como que this apple, even this apple is fake, but at least it has stars on it.
Yeah, it meant something, because even if it's like luxury in the sense of like, it's not the real thing, sure. But for me, this represents I'm doing something right. So when he steals from the cider place, that he was using those apples for him, that was like
that another was Willem Dafoe moment.
Willem Dafoe giving Ratatouille realness.
I mean, it could also be like you see this apple and it's just normal, but for other people, it's valuable, just like you said, Willem Dafoe really wanted to taste the apple cider. So for other people, this could be considered a luxury. And so in a sense, he was kind of teaching them, like, hey, this could be considered, you know what, more valuable than you guys think. I guess.
What scene was this? Oh my god.
Okay, so
it was the final speech. Okay, so I'm gonna go. So I really like how when he gives that speech, his son says it was a good toast. And I don't know, it just makes you feel warm and fuzzy inside. And then they dance.
I do remember the dance.
Yeah. At least
wasn't it inside the place where they were making it?
It was a grocery store.
Okay, mm-hmm. Sí. Ah, okay, ya recuerdo. Yeah, yeah. I still stand by it.
What I really like about that line, every time I think about it and each time I rewatch it, it becomes something new in my head. But this time looking at it, it just really made me think about how we're made up of different parts that, while not be special to other people, or sometimes maybe they don't even feel special to ourselves, they're still special because they're you.
Yes.
Like when he takes off his tail and he's like, now my tail, I have to dry clean it. But it's still on me. It's still a part of me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Also, can I just say, this film was so cussing delightful. I loved it.
Yes! And my next question, which is, I want this as a tattoo because I'm basic. But what do you think the wolf scene means?
Okay, so I have an idea. So we have the main character that throughout the film, he wants to rob again. He wants to go back into what he used to be. He wants to connect with nature in a way. But the thing is, he can't. He can't. He has a family. He has a duty he has to do. However, the wolf, I feel that he, in a way, he respects him because that's something that he wants to be. He wants to be free, but he can't. He can't be like the wolf anymore. So in a way, in that scene where he's, you know what, putting his fist bump up in the air is to show respect.
I love that.
I completely agree with what Anna said. I love the wolf scene.
Yeah.
I feel that when I saw the wolf, I'm like, yes, that also completely validates Mr. Fox's point of view, if you will, on what life was. So when he threw the fist up for me, that was like, you acknowledge that what I believe and what I'm trying to do is right because you're in the same game of survival as I am. And yeah. That phobia of him was him, his phobia of not being good enough to provide for his family as other animals do.
Yeah, he's afraid of the wolf the entire time. Up until that moment where there's that mutual respect, because each time someone mentions a wolf, he's like, wolf where?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Gabriela rated this film 2.5 stars on Letterboxd.
I think that the only valid answer I can give is I plead the fifth.
And Josie will be finding her in the nearest parking lot by her house.
It's just so sad because I love this movie so much.
I know.
The wolf scene made me feel the same way that the jaguar shark scene makes me feel.
I know you love this film. You have told me multiple times that this is one of your favorite films. It was once on your Letterboxd top 4.
Yes.
That's called guilt, Gabriela.
And I gave it a 2.5 and I prepared myself for death. I know
it's just disappointment.
I think that's even worse.
It is worse. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I really like Anna's answer.
Yeah, it's a good answer.
Yeah, it makes me see it differently. It's like he's making peace with what he thought he wanted. Because the entire time he's chasing the good old days, and then it's like, no, what you have in front of you is all that you need.
Yeah, but he was also, in a way, you could say, chasing the American dream of, I want a better life. I want more and more and more. So now that could be seen as a symbolism of, you know what, I just need to value what's really important and not be greedy in the sense of wanting more and more and more.
Mm-hmm. We're moving on to what can be considered his best film to date. That is the 2014 Academy Award-winning film, The Grand Budapest Hotel. I'm just going to start off with the question, and that is, what do you think makes this film stand out?
The production design.
Totally.
Yes.
The color design. That and the color palette.
Yeah. Also, the character interactions were my favorite one.
Yes.
Also, this is the only film I liked.
By the way, I have a question for Anna. When you see the character in prison and you see the uniform, do you or do you not think that they are in the same cinematic universe as Paddington 2?
Oh, yeah. You know what?
Dime que estoy mal. Dime que estoy mal.
Wes Anderson was up to something.
He was the blueprint.
He was the blueprint.
Also, can I just comment that when I Googled a picture of Wes Anderson, he is not at all what I picture when I think of Wes Anderson.
I thought he would look like the white man Bon Iver, to quote Nicki Minaj.
I mean, am I the only one that... Have you all seen Wes Anderson?
I have.
Yes.
Okay, so do you understand what I'm saying?
Completely.
Okay, yeah. Just wanted to point that out. I was like, this man does not look like a Wes Anderson.
Wesley does not look like I thought he would.
So, to me, what makes this film stand out is the fact that you do have a character of color in a prominent role. And yes, they're still kind of like the sidekick, so to speak. But they feel important. You can't have the story without them, which I really liked.
I think that to me is just that the story is so different from the rest of his films.
And it's so funny.
It's very funny, and it's kind of dark.
It is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Willem Dafoe? Also kind of violent. I was not expecting it to choose violence, but it did.
It did.
You know what always gets me? And that's when I realized that I loved this film, was the shootout in the hotel.
Yeah, oh, yeah. I love that. And they were like, what is going on? And they're like, this, and this. Okay, you're all under arrest. Continues the shooting.
Yes.
And yeah, it's just a vibe. Also, can we talk? I thought when I saw Willem Dafoe's character, I thought he was wearing guy liner. And I'm here like... He is truly the blueprint. There he is. But then he wasn't. And I'm here like, well, now I have something to correct. And I rewatched this on the Criterion Collection Blu-ray version. And I can confirm it looks a lot prettier in that version.
Love.
Got it on a 50% off sale. Highly recommend. So if you're a physical media collector and you want a Criterion movie and you love this film, highly recommend you get the Blu-ray for it. It is fantastic. It is a great addition. And it makes it feel even more like a painting that you want to own. Like, honestly, that whole vibe. It's fantastic.
Which I will say, I got my copy of Shiver Baby today, and I'm very excited.
Love that for you.
We love to see
Speaking
it.
Of
love
physical that. Media. Yes, we love to see it.
We do.
Now, moving on from Grand Budapest Hotel, which a lot of people love. We're going into...
It was so good! Come on,
let me... Okay, Gabriela.
This was the only one I liked. Let me say something good.
I don't say. ¿Qué pensaba que había hablado? Go on.
No. I cried at the end. What the fuck was that?
Me with Life Aquatic.
I mean, I remember I texted the group chat, why am I crying at the end of Grand Budapest Hotel? Yeah. And Josie just screamed, hallelujah! Because she knew I had liked it.
Cuando se gana, se gana.
Yeah, and I remember telling.
It's very sad.
And while we're on the subject of Grand Budapest's Oscars, Ralph Fiennes, robbed from the Oscar, he... was not nominated for this role, and I feel that's a crime. But you know what's the bigger crime? This film lost cinematography. Yes, the cinematography Oscar.
Who won?
Birdman.
God fucking damn it.
Hold on.
It did. I understand. I'm not happy, but I understand.
Same, but you know what's ironic? This cinematographer has been with a lot of Anderson's films. He did Rushmore. He did Royal Tenenbaums.
That's what I was going to say. If you think, did he do that cinematography?
I knew it! Because when I was watching Life Aquatic, I was like, this reminds me of Birdman. I am mad.
And he also did, according to this, Moonrise Kingdom. He was the director of photography there. Oh, and you want to top it all off? You know what else he was a cinematographer for? A movie that should be in the Criterion Collection.
I swear, if you say Paddington...
Another film that should be in the Criterion Collection. It's called Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again.
Oh my god.
Of course. Wow, good idea.
He will be doing the cinematography on French Dispatch. So I'm just saying.
He really said, I'm gonna win this Oscar with this other person, and I'm gonna come crawling back to you. No.
He's like the cheating. He's like the cheating partner.
Wow. Bueno, yo espero que French Dispatch gets its accolades because it looks good.
Especially since Mamma Mia was robbed.
I'm scared for French Dispatch. I don't know how I'm gonna react to it now that I've seen Wes Anderson films.
Maybe you shouldn't watch it with Josie on the same day.
All I'm saying is that Wes Anderson gets better with each film. That's yeah, and then fun fact, which I've mentioned in the group chat, Isle of Dogs came out the year when I started grad school. So the sets, which are literally dollhouse-like sets, and the puppets were at the SCAD Museum, and I cried. Which is the perfect segue for the final film we'll be discussing, which is Isle of Dogs, the 2018 film. And we already have talked about it a bit, so let's just get into the discussion with this film. Received mixed reviews from critics due to its incorporation of Asian culture. Some saying the film appropriated it, while others saying they did not find it to be offensive. And this is mostly like when you look up the Wikipedia page, there is a list of Asian critics that did comment against it and for it. So... thoughts. What was your experience going through the film? And yeah, how did you feel? Like beyond the criticism and everything, let's just go into a little bit like first reactions and then how you felt about the usage of Asian culture, considering we did a Studio Ghibli episode last week.
I was just saying that I liked it. Like, it's not my favorite, but I gave it a 3 stars, which is a higher rating than Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Yeah, it was the first film that you commented in the group chat that you were enjoying.
Yeah, I had a good time. I liked the story, but I do remember I have seen some of the discourse surrounding this film, you know, since it came out. I feel like once a month I see a comment on it on Twitter about the cultural aspect of it. And the most that I see is just that it's more of like the cultural appropriation aspect of it, and a few comments on how it feels racist due to Atari being the only Asian character with yellow skin, which yellow skin is, you know, considered racist against Asians. Yeah. So that decision to have that character have that color of their skin is wrong. Yeah, and it's, you know, the comments of it being a film made by a white man about Japanese culture. Yeah, again, I'm not Asian. I can't speak on how accurate it wasn't or not. But, you know, I think the important part of it is that you have to listen to the criticism. And again, you can still enjoy something and be critical of it. Because if you love this film, you know, there's nothing wrong with you liking it and you listening to, you know, you recognizing the problematic aspects of it.
Yeah, because this film really plays into Orientalism.
Mm-hmm.
And a thing that really bothered me, I remember when I was going into this film the first time, I made sure, because there immediately as it was announced and it was screening and everything, people were commenting about the use of Asian culture in this film. And I remember keeping up with everything before watching said film. And one thing that I remember doing is, of course, looking up who was involved. And unfortunately, it was all white people. Wes Anderson did not collaborate with anyone of Asian heritage or anyone that was Asian.
Excuse me, Scarlett Johansson is in this.
Oh, sorry, my excuses. Except, like, with the exception of Scarlett Johansson. And most of the Asian representation was in the actors, which I did like, but unfortunately that is the bare minimum, so do better.
Yeah.
There was involvement in, like, giving credit to an Asian creator when it came to the story by credit, but still that is not enough.
So I did enjoy the film. I thought the story was entertaining. Yes, it does have a little bit of pacing issues, but I was okay with it. The production was really, it was great. I liked the character designs. I liked the casting. The voice acting was really great. However, I do see that this movie could be considered problematic with the cultural appropriation and how it also aligns with the white savior trope.
Yeah.
Where we see it with the dogs, and we also, especially, we kind of see it with Greta Gerwig's character.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Considering, you know, the voice actors of the dogs were, all of them were white, except for Scarlett Johansson, obviously. And I think that's also the same problem in Grand Budapest Hotel. In his films, even when there might be, you know, a character of color, they all fall under the white savior trope. And obviously Isle of Dogs is no exception to it.
I think that the only one that didn't fall with the white savior trope was with The Royal Tenenbaums with Danny Glover.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, he didn't fall in that category when it comes to, like, Wes Anderson films.
Yeah.
So this is going to be my spicy take. I did not love Isle of Dogs. But first, let's do a class exercise as to why I will explain why I love the title. Say Isle of Dogs, and then I love dogs.
I know, I saw that on Wikipedia. I love dogs.
Okay, but this is for the audience to learn.
I love dogs.
So, yeah, I understand that this could be seen on the one hand of... because I'd seen both sides of the coin where some were saying, oh, but this was a passion project to talk about how much love he had for Japan and he was trying to do right by it and that this is a story mainly about propaganda. But I do also see the other side of the coin, which is what Gabriela and Anna were bringing to the table. And for me personally, when I saw this film, I love dogs personally. And I was excited to see a film where they were, like, the main characters. And it's not my favorite Wes Anderson film. Not by much. Not by a lot. Like, it's not going to be up on that list. I feel it's one of his weaker films because, for me, the pacing was a problem. And I don't feel... I'm sorry if this offends someone, but I don't feel the emotional parts were as strong as they could have been. I felt they sometimes lacked genuine impact. As there was in Fantastic Mr. Fox. The pacing for me dragged at some points, the points where I was like, I was really bored, and I was like at the point where I'm like, I'm here for the dogs, I don't care what anyone else is doing. So that for me was
the thing with this film is that Fantastic Mr. Fox definitely has more heart, but Isle of Dogs is a lot more dynamic. I would say it's his most dynamic film.
Yeah, and not every joke landed. Which I get, he was trying to do more serious here in terms of what was being discussed with the dog flu and the propaganda of, like, oh, the problem are dogs, so if we get rid of dogs, we get rid of the dog flu, but it was really something else. And I like the environment Anderson created with Fantastic Mr. Fox more. The animation design, like Anna said, I liked it. I thought it was really nice. I thought especially for the dogs, it was great. The voice cast was great and charming. The world building I felt was fresh and the score was engaging, but it's a flawed film. That's what it is. It's a flawed film because you can go tit for tat for the arguments, but essentially I felt it's a visually stunning film that at times can be enjoyable, but it's not going to connect with everyone. And in fact, it could rub some people the wrong way based on what it's presenting and who is presenting it.
Yeah, it's definitely one of the stories where I do admire what it's trying to do, but was he the person to say to tell the story?
Exactly. Yeah.
Because again, it does play into a lot of that, that you can tell that there is a lot of love that went to this and a lot of care. And there are scenes that were there were scenes that were reminiscent of Sanshiro Sugata to me. So you can tell that he does have inspiration from classic style films. But again, issues with the white man. But also the thing with Isle of Dogs is that it's very typical of Wes Anderson, where it's very visually pleasing, but the script is where it's lacking. So we hope to see some improvements in that aspect with his future work. And one little fun fact that I wanted to note is that the composer, or the person in charge of the score, was none other than Alexander Desplat, who was nominated this year.
Yes, this I know. I recognize it. I like Alexander Desplat.
Yeah.
And you made fun of me because I was rooting for him for composing The Midnight Sky.
Hey, it's a different that we all knew Soul was going to win.
Hey, The Midnight Sky I recognize is Miley Cyrus's Midnight Sky, available now off her new album, Plastic Hearts.
And with that, we can end this episode. That's all for today's episode. We'd like to thank you for listening and to give a shout out to all the kind people sending love our way. If you'd like to keep up with us, make sure to follow us at Film Poser on Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook. Where can they find you, posers?
You can find me on Twitter at Gabby_Burgos27 and on Letterboxd at Gabby Cristina.
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram as Anna_Sofia53 and on Letterboxd as Anna_Sofia.
You can find me on Twitter and on Letterboxd at Leading Mohicans.
And you can find me at the Josie Marie on Twitter and Letterboxd. Again, thank you for listening, and remember, we're all film posers. Bye.
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 Bye.